Chapter 2. Mother of pearl buttons, that seemed to be growing upon him, and to be in a fair way, if it were not pruned of covering his head and overrunning his boots. This gentleman wants to know, said the landlord, if anything seen at the poplars. Hooded woman with a howl, said Ikey, in a state of great freshness. Do you mean a cry?
I mean a bird, sir.
A hooded woman with an owl. Dear me. Did you ever see her?
I seen the owl.
Never the woman?
Not so plain as the owl, but they always keeps together.
Has anybody ever seen the woman as plainly as the owl?
Lord bless you, sir. Lots.
Who?
Lord bless you, sir. Lots.
The general dealer opposite, for instance, who is opening his shop?
Perkins?
Bless you, Perkins wouldn't go a nigh the place.
No, observed the young man, with considerable feeling. He ain't over wise, and Perkins, but he ain't such a fool as that.
Here, the landlord murmured his confidence in Perkins knowing better.
Who is or who was the hooded woman with the owl? Do you know?
Well, said Ikey, holding up his cap with one hand, while he scratched his head with the other, they say, in general, that she was murdered, and the owl hewed it the while. This very concise summary of the facts was all I could learn, except that a young man, as hearty and likely a young man as ever I see, had been took with fits and held down in them, after seeing the hooded woman. Also, that a personage, dimly described as a old chap, a sort of one-eyed tramp, answering to the name of Joby, unless you challenged him as Greenwood, and then he said, why not, and even if so, mind your own business, had encountered the hooded woman, a matter of 5 or 6 times. But, I was not materially assisted by these witnesses. Inasmuch as the first was in California, and the last was, as Ikey said, and he was confirmed by the landlord, anywheres. Now, although I regard with a hushed and solemn fear, the mysteries, between which and this state of existence is interposed the barrier of the great trial and change that fall on all the things that live, and although I have not the audacity to pretend that I know anything of them, I can no more reconcile the mere banging of doors, ringing of bells, creaking of boards, and such like insignificances, with the majestic beauty and pervading analogy of all the divine rules that I am permitted to understand, than I had been able, a little while before, to yoke the spiritual intercourse of my fellow traveler to the chariot of the rising sun. Moreover, I had lived in 2 haunted houses both abroad. In one of these, an old Italian palace, which bore the reputation of being very badly haunted indeed, and which had recently been twice abandoned on that account, I lived 8 months, most tranquilly and pleasantly. Notwithstanding that the house had a score of mysterious bedrooms, which were never used, and possessed, in one large room in which I sat reading, times out of number at all hours, and next to which I slept, a haunted chamber of the first pretensions. I gently hinted these considerations to the landlord. And as to this particular house, having a bad name, I reasoned with him, why, how many things had bad names undeservedly, and how easy it was to give bad names, and did he not think that, if he and I were persistently to whisper in the village, that any weird-looking old drunken tinker of the neighborhood had sold himself to the devil, he would come in time to be suspected of that commercial venture. All this wise talk was perfectly ineffective with the landlord, I am bound to confess, and was as dead a failure as ever I made in my life. To cut this part of the story short, I was piqued about the haunted house, and was already half resolved to take it. So, after breakfast, I got the keys from Perkins' brother-in-law, a whip and harness maker, who keeps the post office, and is under submission to a most rigorous wife of the doubly seceding little Emmanuel persuasion, and went up to the house, attended by my landlord and by Ikey. Within, I found it, as I had expected, transcendently dismal. The slowly changing shadows waved on it from the heavy trees, were doleful in the last degree,
The house was ill-placed, ill-built, ill-planned, and ill-fitted. It was damp, it was not free from dry rot, there was a flavor of rats in it, and it was the gloomy victim of that indescribable decay which settles on all the work of man's hands, whenever it's not turned to man's account. The kitchens and offices were too large, and too remote from each other. Above stairs and below, waste tracts of passage intervened between patches of fertility represented by rooms, and there was a moldy old well with a green growth upon it, hiding like a murderous trap, near the bottom of the back stairs, under the double row of bells. One of these bells was labeled, on a black ground in faded white letters, Master B. This, they told me, was the bell that rang the most. Who was Master B? I asked. Is it known what he did, while he owl hooted? Rang the bell, said Ikey. I was rather struck by the prompt dexterity with which this young man pitched his fur cap at the bell, and rang it himself. It was a loud unpleasant bell, and made a very disagreeable sound. The other bells were inscribed according to the names of the rooms to which their wires were conducted. As, picture room, double room, clock room, and the like. Following Master B.S. bell to its source, I found that young gentleman, to have had but indifferent third-class accommodation in a triangular cabin under the cock loft, with a corner fireplace which Master B. must have been exceedingly small, if he were ever able to warm himself at, and a corner chimney piece like a pyramidal staircase to the ceiling for Tom Thumb. The papering of one side of the room had dropped down bodily, with fragments of plaster adhering to it, and almost blocked up the door. It appeared that Master B., in his spiritual condition, always made a point of pulling the paper down. Neither the landlord nor Ikey could suggest why he made such a fool of himself. Except that the house had an immensely large rambling loft atop, I made no other discoveries. It was moderately well furnished, but sparely. Some of the furniture say, a third was as old as the house. The rest was of various periods within the last half century. I was referred to a corn chandler in the marketplace of the county town, to treat for the house. I went that day, and I took it for 6 months. It was just the middle of October, when I moved in with my maiden sister. I venture to call her 8 and 30. She is so very handsome, sensible, and engaging. We took with us, a deaf stable man, my bloodhound Turk, two women servants, and a young person called an odd girl. I have reason to record of the attendant last enumerated, who was one of the St. Lawrence's Union female orphans, that she was a fatal mistake and a disastrous engagement. The year was dying early, the leaves were falling fast, it was a raw cold day when we took possession, and the gloom of the house was most depressing. The cook, an amiable woman, but of a weak turn of intellect, burst into tears on beholding the kitchen, and requested that her silver watch might be delivered over to her sister, to the Pintox Gardens, Licks Walk, Clapham Rise, in the event of anything happening to her from the damp. Streaker, the housemaid, feigned cheerfulness, but was the greater martyr. The odd girl, who had never been in the country, alone was pleased, and made arrangements for sowing an acorn in the garden outside the scullery window, and rearing an oak. We went, before dark, through all the natural as opposed to supernatural miseries incidental to our state. Dispiriting reports ascended, like the smoke, from the basement in volumes, and descended from the upper rooms. There was no rolling pin, there was no salamander which failed to surprise me, for I don't know what it is, there was nothing in the house. What there was broken, the last people must have lived like pigs, what could the meaning of the landlord be? Through these distresses, the odd girl was cheerful and exemplary. But within 4 hours after dark we had got into a supernatural groove, and the odd girl had seen eyes, and was in hysterics. My sister and I had agreed to keep the haunting strictly to ourselves, and my impression was, and still is, that I had not left Ikey, when he helped to unload the cart, alone with the women, or any one of them, for 1 minute. Nevertheless, as I say, the odd girl had seen eyes no other explanation could ever be drawn from her, before 9, and by 10 o'clock had had as much vinegar applied to her as would pickle a handsome salmon. I leave a discerning public to judge of my feelings, when, under these untoward circumstances, at about 10:30, Master B.S. Bell began to ring in a most infuriated manner, and Turk howled until the house resounded with his lamentations. I hope I may never again be in a state of mind so unchristian as the mental frame in which I lived for some weeks, respecting the memory of Master B, whether his bell was rung by rats, or mice, or bats, or wind, or what other accidental vibration, or sometimes by one cause, sometimes another, and sometimes by collusion, I don't know. But, certain it is, that it did ring 2 nights out of 3, until I conceived the happy idea of twisting Master B.S. neck, in other words, breaking his bell short off and silencing that young gentleman, as to my experience and belief, forever. But, by that time, the odd girl had developed such improving powers of catalepsy, that she had become a shining example of that very inconvenient disorder. She would stiffen, like a Guy Fawkes endowed with unreason, on the most irrelevant occasions. I would address the servants in a lucid manner, pointing out to them that I had painted Master B.S. room, and balked the paper, and taken Master B.S. bell away, and balked the ringing, and if they could suppose that that confounded boy had lived and died, to clothe himself with no better behavior than would most unquestionably have brought him, and the sharpest particles of a birch broom in too close acquaintance in the present imperfect state of existence, could they also suppose a mere poor human being, such as I was, capable by those contemptible means of counteracting and limiting the powers of the disembodied spirits of the dead, or of any spirits? I say I would become emphatic and cogent, not to say rather complacent, in such an address, when it would all go for nothing by reason of the odd girl suddenly stiffening from the toes upward, and glaring among us like a parochial petrifaction. Streaker, the housemaid too, had an attribute of a most discomfiting nature. I am unable to say whether she was of an usually lymphatic temperament, or what else was the matter with her, but this young woman became a mere distillery for the production of the largest and most transparent tears I ever met with. Combined with these characteristics was a peculiar tenacity of hold in those specimens, so that they didn't fall, but hung upon her face and nose. In this condition, and mildly and deplorably shaking her head, her silence would throw me more heavily than the admirable Crichton could have done in a verbal disputation for a purse of money. Cook, likewise, always covered me with confusion, as with a garment, by neatly winding up the session with the protest that the house was wearing her out, and by meekly repeating her last wishes regarding her silver watch. As to our nightly life, the contagion of suspicion and fear was among us, and there is no such contagion under the sky. Hooded woman? According to the accounts, we were in a perfect convent of hooded women. Noises? With that contagion downstairs, I myself have sat in the dismal parlor, listening, until I have heard so many and such strange noises, that they would have chilled my blood, if I had not warmed it, by dashing out to make discoveries. Try this in bed, in the dead of the night. Try this at your own comfortable fireside, in the life of the night. You can fill any house with noises, if you will, until you have a noise for every nerve in your nervous system. I repeat, the contagion of suspicion and fear was among us, and there is no such contagion under the sky. The women, their noses in a chronic state of excoriation from smelling salts, were always primed and loaded for a swoon, and ready to go off with hair triggers. The two elder detached the odd girl on all expeditions that were considered doubly hazardous, and she always established the reputation of such adventures by coming back cataleptic. If cook or streaker went overhead after dark, we knew we should presently hear a bump on the ceiling, and this took place so constantly that it was as if a fighting man were engaged to go about the house, administering a touch of his art, which I believe is called the auctioneer, to every domestic he met with. It was in vain to do anything. It was in vain to be frightened, for the moment in one's own person, by a real owl, and then to show the owl. It was in vain to discover, by striking an accidental discord on the piano, that Turk always howled at particular notes and combinations. It was in vain to be a Rhadamanthus with the bells, and if an unfortunate bell rang without leave, to have it down inexorably and silence it. It was in vain to fire up chimneys, let torches down the well, charge furiously into suspected rooms and recesses. We changed servants, and it was no better. The new set ran away, and a third set came, and it was no better. At last, our comfortable housekeeping got to be so disorganized and wretched, that I one night dejectedly said to my sister, "Patty, I begin to despair of our getting people to go on with us here, and I think we must give this up." My sister, who is a woman of immense spirit, replied, "No, John, don't give it up. Don't be beaten, John. There is another way."
"And what is that?"
said one. "John," returned my sister, "if we are not to be driven out of this house, and that for no reason whatever that is apparent to you or me, we must help ourselves and take the house wholly and solely into our own hands."
"But the servants," said one.
"Have no servants," said my sister, boldly. Like most people in my grade of life, I had never thought of the possibility of going on without those faithful obstructions. The notion was so new to me when suggested, that I looked very doubtful. "We know they come here to be frightened, and infect one another, and we know they are frightened, and do infect one another," said my sister. "With the exception of bottles," I observed, in a meditative tone.
"The deaf stable man. I kept him in my service, and still keep him, as a phenomenon of moroseness not to be matched in England."
"To be sure, John," assented my sister, "except Bottles. And what does that go to prove? Bottles talks to nobody, and hears nobody." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.